Hello, everyone, and welcome into this edition of Fun and Then Some. It is our weekly podcast here from the Fun Media Group, and my name is Michael St. John. With me is Adam Ward, and together we form a team to talk a little bit of everything, sports included, which we all have a passion and love for. And we'd like to welcome you in. The month of March has arrived. We're happy about that. Daylight savings time arriving. We're happy about that. And, of course, the coronavirus is arriving, and we're not happy about that. Adam, you get to where every week we look at each other and we say, well, we're not going to have a lot to talk about next week. And then the next week happens, and we got a lot to talk about.
The news cycles giveth, and the news cycle taketh away, and then it giveth again. That's just the way it goes. And fortunately, in our line of business, that breeds good things for us. It helps us to have a lot of things that, you know, different discussions to have. And then, of course, to the people want to know. And believe it or not, some people actually care about what we think out there, you know. So, I mean, it provides a lot of learning opportunities as well. A lot of people wouldn't even think about that. But the news cycle provides a lot of learning opportunities, whether you're talking in the sports world, you're talking politics, which we will not on here, or you're talking medical, science, whatever it might be. It provides a lot of learning opportunities. So we hope that folks are learning right along with us as we give our views and opinions and thoughts on things here on Fun and Then Some, presented by Jerry Dampson Ford. If you need a vehicle, folks, you need to come on down to Arab, Alabama, to Jerry Dampson Ford. They're going to take care of you, put you in a brand new Ford. Maybe you know, got to get on some sort of financial plan. They're more than happy to work with you on that as well. Jerry Dampson Ford, bringing you Fun and Then Some, right here out of Arab, Alabama. Michael, let's get this thing rolling. What you got today?
Well, first of all, you know, this is the month of March, and the lady that used to babysit me when I was a little baby, her name was Mandy.
Mandy.
And Mandy was the sweetest lady. I cried like a baby when she died, and I was only like 7 or 8 years old. And Mandy would take care of me, and she used to say, Mrs. Michael, if you gets by the Januaries and the Februaries, you can march right on. Mm. And that's a great piece of advice, because January and February are always sort of, especially in the South, in this part of the country, yeah, they're the worst months of the year weather-wise.
Yep.
There's not a lot of activities going on. There's some basketball going on, but there's not a big following for basketball in this part of the South. And it's just, there's not a lot going on. But when you get to March and you turn that page and you start seeing the sunshine, and, of course, this year we have had an enormous amount of rain. Mm-hmm. But when you start seeing the sunshine, life sort of, everybody sort of gets a little feeling of resurrection here, a resurrection from wintertime, resurrection from not being able to do what you like to do. And that's the one great thing about living in the South that nobody can deny. It's a type of, it's part of the country where you can spend a lot of time outdoors,
yep,
for much of the year.
Yep.
So for us, it's sort of a rebirth. So my Miss Mandy was right.
Yeah, she was. I had a babysitter. Her name was Amber. And I gave her quite a hard time. I even got her in trouble with her own parents.
Oh.
So I was not I consider myself a good child growing up, but there was a few times with certain people that I guess I grew up one of those kids that I felt like I never needed a babysitter. I tried to be Mr. Independent when I really, you know, couldn't even cook a meal on my own, let alone go to the fridge and pour myself a glass of milk or something like that. So gave her quite a hard time, even locked her out of the house at one point, and she called my mom on me.
So you were one of those kids.
Yeah, at least for the babysitter I was, and it was not due to a crush, I promise you that. In case my wife ever listens to this, I did not have a crush on the babysitter.
Wow.
We all ended up good friends as I grew up and became much more mature. Her family was friends with my family, and her mom especially is my mom's best friend, so I felt kind of appropriate to give them a hard time one way or the other, but never really had great advice from a babysitter. I just gave her a great hard time, though.
I had a high school teacher in Huntsville High named Amber. I wish she would have babysat me.
Oh,
I would have loved to have babysat her. When I was 23, I was programming WMPS in Memphis, and we had our son was a little over a year old, and we hired a babysitter who was one of my record reps with Arista Records.
Mm-hmm.
It was her granddaughter, and that little girl was the best babysitter ever.
Yeah.
Hmm. Even for daddy. But, I mean, it was a great. She was a wonderful baby. And she's married and has a great family now. And I mean, you know, I think babysitting could be a lost art in this day and time. You know, we have our grandson, Joshua, and we get to keep him from time to time. And he's a good kid. I mean, 7 months old and just a happy kid and a good kid. And we're blessed. And of course, we're blessed to have him, but we're blessed to have his behavioral side of the world, too. But it's tough to find babysitters in this day and time. Not that you don't trust them, but it's a different era of babysitters. Back in the day, at least with me and with my kids, they would engage the kids in, mm-hmm. in play or in reading or doing this or doing that, even maybe even watching TV. But in this day and time, I hear a lot of babysitter tales where they're on their phone and texting and all that good stuff, and the baby's around raising havoc.
Yeah, and playing with the guns.
And they're not paying the attention that they need. And the kid needs a child needs attention, not only for making sure that they don't get in harm's way, but they need attention to help grow in their maturation of life, whether they're 7 months old, 7 years old, 77 years old, whatever the case may be. You grow in life. And babysitters do provide a role.
Right. I was never entrusted with another person's kids growing up, especially in the teenage years. I guess you could say I babysitted my little brother when he came around, but I mean...
You babysat.
Babysat. I never really considered that, though, babysitting, if you will. I never really... Because that's family. But I've got two sisters, and especially my little sister, Kylie, she... when she turned 16 and could drive on her own, she went from babysitting the neighbor's kids to driving all over Kingdom Come because somebody offered to pay her, you know, $60 to come babysit for 4 or 5 hours, you know, on a Friday night or something while mom and dad went out. And, you know, she made her a little money on that. And,
good
and,
for her.
But she, my parents had a philosophy, and they implemented it even well into my little brother in that you don't get a cell phone until we believe you're ready. It's not an age thing with them. It's not when you turn 14, we're going to give you one kind of deal, or when you get your license even. A lot of parents have that deal now. If you get your license, you'll get a cell phone because we need to be able to know where you're at. It was more of when we believe you're ready. I didn't have my first cell phone until I was 17 years old, my junior year of high school. And even that, smartphones had just really started to come on the scene, and it wasn't even a smartphone. It was a basic little flip phone that barely had a camera that would do anything on it. So you could surf the web, but it was going to cost you like 24 cents a minute or whatever to do that. So there was never any of that. Kylie never got a cell phone until she was about 16 years old, which was, you know, right around the time she could drive. But between me, Miranda, my first younger sister, and then Kylie, Kylie was the most mature by that point between all three of us.
Gotcha.
So she had earned it, but I had gone over there a couple of times just to like bring her dinner or something while she's babysitting. You know, they wanted pizza, but Kylie was afraid to get out and drive the kids around. She's a new driver, so she'd call me up and say, hey, they left money for pizza. Can you get it? And I'll give you the money for it. And I'd go over there and I'd bring it to them. But when I'd go in there, her phone would literally be on the kitchen table while she was in the living room playing blocks with them or coloring or you know, going outside if it was a nice day, whatever it was. So, but I think that's sort of, like you mentioned, a little bit of a lost art today, because you watch on TV now, you see all these commercials about download this app and find yourself a trusted babysitter, care.com, or whatever all this mess is. I got a lot of issues with a bunch of that, because I think you got to be extremely careful with finding somebody on, you know, we're talking about predators in this day and time, and we're living in an age where, you know, men don't care to go in the women's bathroom and just claim to be women and go do different things. Well, it's no different on the internet. You got to be careful. And so I prefer that if I'm going to, you know, when Beverly and I are fortunate enough to have kids, if the good Lord wills, I'm not going to go to the internet to go find somebody. I'm going to find somebody I already know that I already trust.
And that's I think that's the safe way of doing it is fine. And that's how we always did it. Our babysitters were either somebody we knew who had a young daughter. And at one point we had a young man that actually did and did a great job. or we knew they knew somebody that they had had or used that they could trust, and they, and we always vetted on it. You know, the word vetted is a word that's thrown around these days, but back in the day, you did background checks,
right?
And that's what we do. You know, that's what we did, and I'm sure that that's what Cody and Katie will do when it's time to. But right now, they don't have to worry about babysitters because between Katie's mama and daddy, and between me and Miss Melanie, we'll take the kid anytime the kid's available. You know, the novelty is not worn off yet. But,
no, probably won't for a while.
But when you do, I think it's key that you. You also said something that makes a lot of sense to me, and I was raised in that same way. That you, and more so with the car situation than with the phone situation with Chris and Jamie, mm-hmm. was we're not going to give you a car just because you turned 16 and got your license.
Right.
And you're going to have to earn it. And you're going to have to prove to us that you are responsible enough to have the car.
Yeah.
And with Christopher, the deal was, and Christopher was a good kid, and the deal was he played football, but he was a defensive lineman at Gallatin High School and at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks. And we made and half jokingly over the summer of his senior year, he was turning 16, and we made this, well, actually it was his junior year, and we made this joke with him. And one day we were out on the beach and we said, okay, here's the deal. You turn 16, you get your license, you keep your grades up, you score a touchdown, you get a car. He's a defensive lineman. He runs a 14-minute and 32-second 40. I mean, you know, there's no way. No way. And lo and behold, in the playoffs that year, his junior year, against a team called Villa Park, we were down playing at this at a junior college stadium there in Los Angeles. In fact, we're right next door to where the Rams play now.
Yeah.
Not the Rams, the Chargers.
Chargers.
And we were playing a team called Villa Park, and and the quarterback dropped by back in the second quarter, the game's tied. Quarterback drops back. He's on his, like, 40, on our 40-yard line, on the Notre Dame 40. And Villa Park, he drops back for a pass, and the coach, the defensive coordinator, called a twist, an inside blitz, outside defensive end, inside defensive tackle, who was Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chris beat his man, came around the edge, beat his man. And as the kid went toward the quarterback turned with his ball back cocked to throw, and Chris snatched it out of his hand. I mean, it wasn't fumbled or anything. He just grabbed it and went 67 yards for a touchdown. And he turns to the side, and I'm on the sideline, and I'm going nuts, and his mother's in the stands, and she's filming or trying to film, and we got a great, great video for it, which we got to college recruiters. But anyway, long story short, he turns around, he comes to the sideline, and instead of celebrating with his kid, he looks to his mother and does the moving of a steering wheel like this. So at the end of the game, we at halftime, we were laughing. We said, okay, now we've really put a foot in our mouth this time. And at the end of the game, we said, we're going to live up to it. And, you know, we'll go out over the weekend and see what there is. And he found a Jeep. And he really wanted the Jeep, and it was not in great shape, but it was. It had a great engine, a great running vehicle, but it was just the physical part of it was pretty ugly. So anyway, we bought him that Jeep, and he cleaned it up, and we got a paint job, and he got him new floor mats, and we had to go to the only time I was ever in Watts. That I had to go to Watts for something, living there for 4.5 years. We had to go to Watts on a Saturday afternoon to pick up his top, his rack top for it, and to pick up the side things for the doors, whatever. So we're going to Watts on a Saturday afternoon, but thank goodness it was at 1:30. We went right to the place, and it was all fenced in with barbed wire on top of it, and the guy saw us coming, he opened the gate and got us in, closed the gate. And we got the accessories, and then we left. Had no incident, no problem whatsoever. It was an interesting area to see. But, I mean, that was, again, you know, we had determined that he was ready for a vehicle.
Right.
But, and I'll be honest with you, Adam, it was pretty scary turning a kid loose, or your son loose, in Southern California with a car than it would be turning your child loose in Arab, Alabama with a car.
Right.
But actually, it turned out to be better because he really learned quickly to be a defensive driver.
Yeah.
And God bless his soul, has never had a wreck. So, you know, I guess it was a good thing, but it, yeah, that gets scary too. But I like the idea that that to me is parenting. Mm-hmm. When you decide when your child is ready for something special that takes them to that next step in life.
Yeah, yeah, that certainly, and I think my folks went that way after me. If I'm being really honest, I think I taught them a lesson, in at least on the car side of it, because when I was growing up, for Christmas, I was 15 years old. Or I might have been 16, but anyway, it was right around that time. I still didn't have my license yet. My parents didn't feel I was mature enough in that way because my grades were not great. They weren't A's and B's. I was making B's and C's, and C's in my household were not acceptable. And at that time, it didn't really bother me, but my parents felt like I guess I needed a poking, a little cattle prod to the backside or something. And for Christmas, one year, they decided that they were going to buy each of the kids, and this was before my little brother came along, that they were going to buy each of the kids one big gift. And I mean expensively big. Mm-hmm. And everything else was going to be $3 movie here, $5 movie there, thing of candy in your stocking, you know, here's you some underwear kind of stuff. My little sister Kylie got a fenced-in trampoline deal, which I unfortunately broke. That's a story for another day.
You didn't weigh much then back then either.
No. That's a brave story, and I can tell that one later. But Miranda got a Bach Stradivarius trumpet, which if anybody's listening that knows anything about band, you know that that trumpet is, at that time, was the most expensive on the market, and it may still be. I haven't done the research on that in quite some time. But she was seriously dedicated to playing the trumpet for the high school band, and would later go on to play 4 years in the Million Dollar Band at the University of Alabama. Mm-hmm. On the trumpet. And her very first year, her freshman year, most freshmen don't get in on the ball game at all except to play in the stands. The rest of it for halftime or for pregame stuff, they're standing on the sidelines. Well, her very first game against San Jose State in 2010, she called us up on that Friday night. She said, "You guys got to get to Tuscaloosa tomorrow somehow, some way, because I'm going to be on the field. I'm going to be in the show.
I'm marching."
Yeah. Said, "I beat the guy out that was in front of me as a freshman, and he was a senior."
Wow, that's great. That Stradivarius trumpet.
Yeah, yeah. But she took that thing, and, I mean, she still got it. She can still well on that thing.
Wow.
But those things were expensive, to go back to the original point.
What'd
mine
you get?
Was a 2000 Ford Explorer Sport.
Wow.
Which, to my parents at that time, cost a little over $3,000, which was expensive for them at that time. My dad was out of work, had been laid off, and things of that nature. So we were going through a rough time, but they wanted to make sure that Christmas was memorable, but I also felt like it was sort of a prod to me. And they said, "Well, you know what, you have your permit, so you can drive it, but we've got to be in the car with you," mm-hmm. you know. And so I'll never forget the first time I ever drove it. We were going to Fort Payne Sheriff's Office prison, and we were going with the church, and we were presenting the church Christmas program to the inmates, mm-hmm. Which they have since done, I think, almost every year. And it has become very popular. You've heard about it, talked a little bit about it on our station come Christmas time. I mean, all sorts of a lot of churches are now doing that because of Nazareth. But little shout out there, shameless plug. But that was used as sort of a, look, if you really want to, you're 16 and all you got your permit and all your friends are driving. If you really want to join them and get your license and not have to worry about mommy and daddy being in the front seat with you, get your act together. Prove to us that you can handle this responsibility. I mean, you've got the prize sitting in front of you now. Mm-hmm. We've gone that far for you. But until you can prove to us that you can handle this, we're not going to take you to get your license. And fat boy here, within 6 months, had his grades up and done more around the house and just tried to be a better person for it and ended up getting my license. Then what did I do? I go back to messing it all up again.
Well, no, because, and think about this, is that, you know, again, that's parenting. And
yeah.
Again, I give them kudos on that, because they gave you a goal to achieve.
Yeah.
But you had to do your part, which motivated you to do your part.
Yeah.
That's what parenting is about.
And originally it was going to be no license, no car deal,
right,
as far as we're not even going to get you one. But I was going to be the first one to drive. You know, you see a lot of these sitcoms where it's like they can't wait for the first kid to get their car so they can make them go to the grocery store.
Right.
I think that is actually sort of a thing. I think we overplay it a little bit on TV, but I think that to some degree, I'm not a parent, but I think that is to some degree a factor in, well, I can send him to the store instead of me having to go, or I can make him go pick up little sister. You know.
I see that as a trend, parenting trend, that has come on within the last 15 years. Whereas the parents of this generation that's out today, which are the sons and daughters of baby boomers,
now, yeah,
are now ready to get their child out of the house before he ends up in their basement till he turns 33.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean, and that's, yeah. You know, and people say, well, you know, a lot of kids can't. Yeah, they can make it. They're not pushed and motivated to do it. If your kid's living in your basement right now or in the spare room at your house, and he's over 21 and he's been to college or been to trade school or got a job or whatever the case may be, he needs to be out on his own.
Yeah.
That's part of growing up. That's part of maturity. That's part of life.
Yeah. And that was the same way for me. And it took me a little longer. The difference was at that time, the only thing that was going on between me and my parents at that time was basically it was just a room. Mm-hmm. If I wanted something to eat, I would, especially specifically, I would have to go get it myself. Right. I had to pay my own bills, had to pay for my own car, pay my own insurance. I even started, you know, paying for my own cell phone, which I was even told you don't have to do that. You don't have to pay for your cell phone. You can be on the family plan and it'll save you a bunch of money. But I went ahead and took the hard route and said, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to, and to this day, you know, I'm married now and my wife and I don't even have a shared phone plan. I'm still on my own. One day we might change that one day, but I don't feel that that's totally important. But I had to change a lot of things up. And when Beverly and I were going to get married, the one thing about it was that got to find a place. And working the job that I was working at that time made things a little bit hard because it was a part-time job. The money wasn't there, and I was too stupid to hold on to it anyway for longer than an hour after I got it cashed out or something. So just had to make a lot of changes, do a lot of growing up. You know, you and I have talked off mic about this on numerous occasions, whether it's on a personal level or just in general, but you know, every person in life, especially you and I being men, we all have to cross a certain bridge.
And Jackass Bridge. Yeah. That's what my cousin called it. I agree with him.
At some point, I had to cross that bridge or else marriage was not going to be an option, period.
Well, when I learned to drive, my dad or mom wouldn't teach me. I mean, they were teaching him. So my mom's best friend, who was a school teacher, Ann Westrop, taught me to drive. And she had a Rambler. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with a Rambler. You're mighty young, but Ramblers back then, instead of changing the gear with a gear shift, and it was an automatic, and I never learned to drive a stick, so I can barely drive a stick because I learned on an automatic.
Yeah.
But when you changed gears, you pushed a button.
Yep.
You pushed from drive to, or from neutral to drive, or park to new, you know, reverse, or whatever the case may be. You pushed a button on the console, and that's how you changed gears. Hmm. So I learned, and then when I took my driver's test and said, well, just take it in my car, and it was up by Maple Hill Cemetery in Huntsville, and so I took it right there, and they drove me through and around the cemetery and everything, and I made 100%, and I was scared. Every kid back then was scared they were going to fail parallel parking,
mm-hmm.
and I was one backup, and I was in. I pulled up, looked at it, judged it, backed into it, and he made you park on the left-hand side, not on the right-hand side, and I was right-handed, so I had to park on the opposite side of the street. And I remember this state trooper looking at me, and he's writing. And I looked at him, and he said, you did good. I said, well, thank you, sir. So I passed. He said, you made 100. And I was like, oh, thank you. So right away, got my license. But I didn't get a car. That was I was just entering I was in my senior year at Huntsville High. But I didn't get my car, a car, until I was a junior at Vanderbilt.
Hmm.
And then my uncle John, my godfather, traded and bought a new, and I ended up with a unair-conditioned four-door Chevy Chevelle. And it didn't have a radio, and it didn't have air conditioning. And I had that my second semester of my junior year in college. And then during that summer, I was working at Way Radio in Huntsville. I was working at WDXB in Chattanooga. and I was working in Nashville at WMAK part-time and just shuffling them all and doing weekends at WMAK and WDXB and doing vacations for the disc jockeys at Way that were going on vacation, and Mr. Smith and MD Smith and Mr. Buxton, Lynn Buxton decided they could trust me and I could do it, and I did it. And I'd had a great summer, but I blew out the engine on my car. So wow. When I went back to college my senior year, I went to Hippodrome Oldsmobile on Broadway, where the freeway loops around the western brow of the city of downtown under Broadway, right there by the train station, across the street from the train station, and bought a car from a gentleman. And my dad had to co-sign for it, but I bought a brand new Oldsmobile Cutlass, a 1972 Oldsmobile Cutlass. And so I was in high cotton. And so anyway, but I think in this day and time, it is a whole different world. Speaking of a different world, this is getting lost between the coronavirus and the presidential and the campaigns on the politics side. I think this is getting lost in the count. And I want to bring it up because I think it's important, and it is...
What's that?
The count, i.e. the census.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people in this country, and more people than I'd like to think here, even in this part of the country, the South, that think this is some kind of evil plot by the government to either take things away or raise your taxes or do something sinister. Where in reality, the census is a way for the government to see... how many people live in what town, what city, what county, what area, what state, to be able to divide up tax money to the states for this helping the states run themselves. That's what it's for.
Right.
And if you look, and a lot of people here like to refer biblically to things, why and where was Jesus born? He was born in Bethlehem. Why was he born in Bethlehem? They had to go back to their hometown. Yes. Why?
Taxes.
They're counting a census.
Yeah.
They were taking the census. Caesar Augustus said he wanted to count all the people in the Fertile Crescent. So it's biblical, folks. You need to participate honestly in the census. We had a really nice lady come by the radio station the other day from the Cherokee tribe locally.
Mm-hmm.
And they left us a flyer. It says American Indians Count. And they're doing an event in Gunnersville, Alabama on the 28th, where they've got a guest speaker from the Tribal Partnership Atlanta office of the U.S. Census Bureau, because the American Indians get benefits from this census count as well. And unfortunately, in our part of the country, I mean, we go back to this sad, sad scenario of the Trail of Tears, but we have a lot of people that are Native American or Native American descendants that don't get counted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. I don't know. I guess it is sort of a touchy subject with a lot of folks, but I mean...
But why?
That's the part I don't understand.
Me
I mean,
too.
It's not really that difficult. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I'm fairly young, okay? And I've just now got my first house. My wife and I are finally establishing ourselves. As far as I can remember, it's basically from time to time somebody just comes up to your door and just talks to you for a second.
And they made it easy. Now you can go online.
Yeah.
You don't even have to worry about somebody coming to your door. You go online, you answer about a dozen questions, and it's done.
Right.
And but it is important. The last census here in this area, and we live in a subdivision. We live on the eastern side of the subdivision that surrounds a small lake.
Mm-hmm.
And we never, ever had a census taker come to our door.
Really?
And my mother-in-law, Nanny, lives at the house, and she never leaves. Damn. But she never leaves. And so she's always there. So when the census people would come by, she would be there to answer the questions or to take a lot of times they'll leave the questionnaire.
Right.
And then you can mail it back in or fax it back in or text it back, or email it, whatever you need to do. But if the count has started.
Yeah.
And within this month, you should be seeing a census person at your door, at least canvassing the neighborhood, to take the count. Take time out and take care of business and be counted.
Yeah. I mean, it's not costing you anything.
Here's the other thing. You know, we're in an election year, and we're not talking politics. I'm just talking about the way it works, okay? So I'm not getting politically involved here. But the more people that are in a state, the more representatives, the more representation you have in Congress.
Yeah.
The number of state representatives are dependent on the number of people living in your state.
Yeah.
In the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you want to be represented to the fullest? So stand up and be counted.
Yeah. Plain and simple. It's not hard, folks. I mean, it's really not. I mean, being my wife and I are the only two people in the house, we don't have somebody there all the time. We both normally don't get home till about 6 or 6:30 in the evening, so we're probably going to miss somebody. But, I mean, they'll leave it at the door, like right. you mentioned, or in some cases, just go online. It's not really that big a deal. You're not having to whip the wallet out and pull the credit card out or do anything that might potentially come back on you.
Right.
It takes just a few minutes out of your day. What are you going to do with that other few minutes? Are you going to peruse Facebook? You're gonna.
And by the way,
I'm gonna leave that alone.
The website is so hard to remember. No, it's actually easy. USCensus.gov.
Yeah.
Pretty easy. Yeah. USCensus.gov.
Yeah.
And it is your duty. By the way, if you're a citizen, by law, you are supposed to report in the census.
Right. That's right. So, speaking of keeping count, I want to move gears here. And, of course, many folks know if they've been listening to this radio station any amount of time, especially in the last 6 or 7 years, they know that my area, I guess you could say, and I don't want to blow my own head up, but area of expertise is the sports world. So we're going to kind of go to sports. But considering the count, Nick Saban has been having to count his coaching staff a lot lately, especially over the last several years. Coaching carousel happening. Well, people were shocked last month, Michael, when one of the old faithfuls, if you will, Scott Cochran, left Alabama to go to Georgia. Have you seen the new details that have emerged out of that and how things got nasty?
Can't say I have. Now, I know I have actually the new gentleman, not the doctor, not Dr. Shea, but the other guy that they have hired from the University of Indiana is a pupil of my friend, Doc Kreese.
David Ballou.
Yeah, David Ballou. In fact, Ballou played under when Doc was the weight coach or the strength and conditioning coach at either Colorado or I forget what college, UCLA, wherever Doc was. And so he's a pupil of Doc Kreese.
Yeah.
Doc Kreese is probably the most well-established, most renowned. He's got 14 books on weight training and so forth already, and two of them New York Times bestsellers. And this is a pupil of his. So I can, and knowing Doc and Doc and counting Doc as a friend from his days at Vanderbilt and MTSU, I can assure you that this person is going to be daggum good.
Yeah. Well, it turns out, first of all, many people may or may not know that he actually ended up taking a pay cut, did Cochran, to go to Georgia to be the special teams coordinator. Surprised some folks that he took the pay cut, but with the new details emerging as to why he would go ahead and take the pay cut, it might explain it a little bit. Things got a little bit volatile within the program in the last 4 months that people on the outside wouldn't even know about. Early in December, after the Iron Bowl and after the SEC Championship had been played between LSU and Georgia, apparently, from what we understand, Cochran reached out to Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss about his open special teams coordinator's position. And for whatever reason, that didn't work out. Kiffin, basically, as I understand it, told him no. Well, then, you and I both were keeping up with the Michigan State job when Mark D'Antonio stepped down and officially, effectively retired for all intents and purposes, not looking for another job. He contacted the officials at Michigan State before there was ever even a head coach in the building, looking just to say, I want a spot on the staff, period. And they told him, well, we can't do that until we have a head coach. He let him form his own staff. And, of course, they went and got the guy from Colorado State, I think it was. I think it was Colorado.
Yeah, it was Mel Tucker from Colorado.
That's right, former Alabama guy. There's the irony in that. But then apparently he tried to go to the New York Giants right after that.
So he was looking.
He was looking, but why was he looking was the question. And apparently he and Nick Saban had started having some butting of the heads and some brush-ups, as the quote is used. There was some fires beginning to build up there, and the lack of trust began to really build up. And by the time it was all said and done, it has been reported that he had lost Nick Saban's trust, and Nick Saban lost his trust in Scott Cochran.
If you saw the TV commercial and the look Nick Saban gave him, you would understand.
Yeah, telling him how to produce his lunch. But he ended up contacting Kirby. Kirby did not contact him at Georgia. He contacted Kirby and basically said, I just want to get out. I want to do, you know, and first of all, kudos to the guy. He wants to, you know, he wants to make a coaching change. He wants to actually do more, and that's, I will never fault a man for that. But he called Kirby Smart and just said, you know, please, I you got an open position. Give me a chance. Give me a chance.
And didn't Mark Antonio D'Antonio end up somewhere, though? Isn't he back on the coaching somewhere?
Not yet? That I'm aware of, no. I haven't heard anything.
I wanted to say it was one of the small, and I know it wasn't the Canadian League, but and it's not the XFL, so I don't know where it would be. But I could have swore I read his name somewhere.
I figure he'll probably end up on the Big Ten Network at least for a year or so doing some work there for them. But
you know, he and Coach Saban are good buddies. He could be an analyst here at Alabama.
Saban's already got like four analyst. Head coaches as an analyst now.
I love that.
But yeah, that's kind of become a very volatile situation down there in Tuscaloosa, apparently. And the quote said there were other coaches involved, but would not name them.
Most recently, in a regular season game, Vanderbilt defeated Alabama at Alabama, and the very next night, Texas A&M goes into Auburn. Auburn with a chance to be a top four seed, and beats Auburn at home for the first time this year. What is it with Texas A&M basketball? They never win a game except when they can screw somebody else up.
Yeah, well, that seemed to be the Alabama's motto this year, too. But, I don't know. My question is not so much about Texas A&M as it is Auburn. You know, you got Bruce Pearl, who is, you know, tossing out, and this is hard for me being a Bama fan, but tossing out any of the past allegations, including this NCAA probe that is still very much alive and ongoing between them and the FBI, and Bruce Pearl is somewhat in the heart of this thing still, although I don't know that as long as this has been drawn out, I don't know anything will ever come out of it. They go all the way nearly last year. I mean, had a shot to get in the championship game.
Mm-hmm.
This year, yeah, they lost some talent, but they've got an extraordinary amount of talent back. And it's you know, I used this term earlier in the year to describe Alabama. Now late in the year, I don't even know what they are. Auburn is Jekyll and Hyde. One game, you're going to get the best basketball team probably in the country on the floor. And then the very next night, the very next game from Tuesday to Saturday or Saturday to Wednesday, whatever it is, it's like they decided to take time off, a week off at a time. And I don't know what's going on. I mean, listen, the SEC needs good basketball programs. They can't just have Kentucky, okay? That's like football having to have a college football having to have a lot of great teams. USC's got to be one. Notre Dame's got to be one. Alabama has got to be one. Especially in the last 20, 30, 40 years, LSU's got to be one.
Nebraska.
To be one.
Texas.
Yes. So all of these,
Penn State.
They need it. But in basketball, it's a little bit different because in basketball, there is no D1s versus, you know, D1 level, D2 level, D3 level. Anybody can get in to the big dance.
Right.
So they do it a little different. So you have to have some big-name schools be good. That's just the nature of the beast. And Auburn the last couple of years has supposedly been that team. But they have, you know, it's one thing to have a few games where you have a bad night. You're going to have that. But every other game, I mean, earlier in the year, they lost by nearly 20 to Alabama and then turned around 4 days later and lost by like 24 to Florida. And Florida was still trying to find their groove halfway through the conference.
Well, see, my deal about basketball, I'm certainly not a college basketball fan. And forget high school basketball. That could go away and I could care less. But then this is personal, okay? This is just personal. I watch the NBA when it gets down to about this part of the season right on through the tournament because I was in an NBA city. I had season tickets. I did some NBA basketball games, be it the Summer Pro League while I lived in California for Prime Ticket with Walter Davis. And so I have a little feel for it, and I got to know some of the people back in the mid-90s that were involved and got to meet some of the – and talk to them and sit at a dinner table for 2.5 hours and just listen to people talking shop. And let me say something, and one thing, and my good friend Eddie Johnson always said that he said in the NBA, He said, you're playing 72 games, and you're playing 60 minutes. And if you're a starter, you're up and down that floor probably 45 of those minutes every night.
Yeah.
Every night. And you don't play two nights a week like they do in high school or in college.
Mm-hmm.
You play sometimes three, sometimes four nights a week.
Yeah.
And there's going to be times that your legs are gone and you just aren't going to play. I mean, the team is just not going to play. So as a result, you're going to lose nine times out of ten. In basketball, unlike football, you can scout your opponent, but you can only scout them for a very tight window.
Mm-hmm.
In college football or pro football, you can scout for days and months and years in advance. Get what you're going to see what you're getting.
Right.
But the other thing that he always said about, and this is very true about the college game, is that you only need five to play, and you only need one superstar or two really good players mm-hmm. to be really good. But in college, you also have to factor in the fact that those kids that are running up and down that court two or three times a week in a game and then practicing also have to mix academics into it at some degree.
Yep.
Even if it is basket weaving, you've still got to do some work. And that in the college game, it will never personify itself to be as good as the pros, not because the talent isn't there, but because of the time factor that is involved and the youth of the people that are involved.
Yeah.
And it always made a lot of sense, and I think Eddie was right. And I think that when you look at an Auburn in this particular situation, or you look at Alabama being slapped in the face by a god-awful Vanderbilt team, it's just going to happen. And the factors that factor into it are not one or two things, but are multiple things coming from the academic world, the personal world, the professional world, the collegiate world, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and considering just the SEC alone, you talk Kentucky basketball and then everybody else. And you and I kind of had this conversation a couple of weeks ago in that I do think basketball is sort of becoming a little bit more relevant in the state of Alabama because of a personality like Bruce Pearl came to Auburn when he did. I think that sort of helped boost that on the plains, especially down towards South Alabama. And then Alabama got a guy by the name of Avery Johnson, who you and I both respect very much, had the chance on several opportunities to talk with him and pick his brain on different things and watch him coach. And I don't think, though, that helped kind of build the reputation, at least for basketball, from Tuscaloosa up, if you will. However, I think that this guy, Nate Oates, even though he doesn't carry the same weight as the name of Bruce Pearl does or a John Calipari or even a Mike Krzyzewski at Duke or anybody like that, I still think he brings an attitude that Alabama hasn't seen in a long time, probably since the days of Wimp Sanderson, to where we want to be just as good, if not better, than the football team. Now that's never going to happen. But
God forbid.
But I think that it does, at least if you watch his post-game press conferences, you hear what he's saying. It's a lot different than the coach speak that they've had with Avery Johnson, with Anthony Grant, and with even Mike Godfrey before that. I think Nate Oates, given some time, and this is sort of a hard take because it is Alabama basketball, and we're talking about a guy that does not carry the same weight as Bruce Pearl. I think if you give him some time, he can make a love for Alabama basketball for a lot of fans. Now, you're going to have those that are always going to be stuck on football and those who just don't care about basketball, period, because this is the South. This is football territory. Well, but I think it's becoming a little bit more relevant to people, but winning does that.
I really felt like Alabama picked the lowest fruit off the tree when they hired Nate Oates. He was from the University of Buffalo. He had one good year. And Alabama, I think, was just sowing some wild oats.
That's a bad one.
Thank you. But the fact of the matter is I think they could have gone bigger name, better program, and gotten somebody with a little bit more experience down the road. And I'm not disagreeing with you that 5 years from now, Nate Oates may be in the top 10 of all college coaches in America if he continues to improve and can make a basketball program that has been middle of the pack for the most part.
Yeah.
To be a prominent contender with a Kentucky. Alabama basketball will never be Kentucky. Excuse me. Alabama basketball will never be Kentucky basketball. Mm-hmm. Kentucky football will never be Alabama football.
Yeah.
Ain't going to happen.
Right.
And so you got to admit what your shortcomings are, what the height of the ceiling is before you try to bust the glass ceiling. I've always said, one of my favorite quotes, before you bust the glass ceiling, you better figure out where the ceiling is.
Right, right.
And so that, and I talked to DJs about that and people that, I want to be a disc jockey in Los Angeles or I want to do this in New York. I'm like, before you bust that glass ceiling, you better find out where your ceiling is.
Yeah.
Because your ceiling may not be, it may be Cincinnati, it may be Memphis, it may not ever get to New York, Chicago, L.A., unless right. you work at it.
Right.
And that was always the point. But that's my point about this. And, there's a following for Alabama basketball. I can tell you, living in Los Angeles and witnessing UCLA basketball, living on the border of Kentucky and watching Kentucky basketball, the fever, the passion, the desire, the encompassment of Alabama football will mm-hmm. never reach anything near that for Alabama basketball.
No, of course
but
not.
It does, that same fever, that same passion, that same drive for Alabama football that drives the fans of Alabama football is present in the fans that drive that's driving that passion for Kentucky basketball or UCLA basketball.
No,
those are just the two areas that I am familiar
yeah.
with. But, and the thing about the NCAA tournament in my lifetime, it's done a bell curve, and I'm on the downside of the curve. It's gotten to where now I don't give a hoot about it. It used to be 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I'd take Thursday off on my satellite TV so I could watch 5 games at once because I was interested in the NCAA tournament. This year, other than the fact the Dayton Flyers are good under Anthony Grant, who, by the way, guess where he coached?
Mm-hmm.
Alabama. The Flyers are good, and that's my dad's hometown, and I have some kin people that are alumni of there, so I'm rooting for them. Other than that, I couldn't tell you who's number one on any given day in college basketball, and don't really care.
I saw a graph the other day on Twitter, and I thought it was really interesting because each week the new polls will come out, and you'll see movements and transitions and all that. But I've never seen it put in this way. It was a moving graph, and it was almost like a GIF, if you will, on Twitter or whatever it was. And it showed from preseason rankings, the official top ones that they released like 2 weeks before the basketball season started up until that point. And all it was a running bar graph, moving literally, and it had the logos of each team
going up
and down.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing to see the movement this time around, not just from – and it only showed the top 10. It didn't show the whole top 25. Just showed the top 10, but it was amazing to see the movement in and out. You had your Dukes and your Michigan States and everybody that's typically good, Kentucky, and all these. Virginia, after winning it last year, they've got to be in there, of course. But the movement was crazy that each week, I don't know that we've had multiple consecutive weeks where the number one team was that number one team the week before mm-hmm. because of the movement of the way this college basketball season has flowed. Of course, Alabama fans take a lot of pride in seeing Auburn go on the upward trend, then all of a sudden they lose to Alabama and they nosedive
right,
back out of the top
right.
10. But a lot of other teams did that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this year has sort of been the most fluent, if you will, of, well, is this team number two? Or are they number four, eight, 12? What are they this week? I mean, last week they were number three, but they barely won in double overtime to a team that's got a losing record. So what are they now? The NCAA tournament this year, I think, is going to be – I think it'll be fun, but I think this might be, quite frankly, because like you mentioned the Dayton Flyers. You've got other teams that are not – and I want to say they're not perennial powers only because they don't come from a big conference that is big in basketball, like a Gonzaga or a Wichita State or somebody like that. Those names you hear quite a lot because they are good at basketball. But they don't come from a big conference.
Right.
So I think this is the year that if there was ever a time for some of these smaller conferences, the Sun Belts or the WAC conferences or anybody like that, I think this might be the year that if there's going to be one of those teams come out of those that can take the title, I think this would be the year because these top-tier teams, again, Duke has I've never seen Duke be as up and down the last few years as I've ever seen them. North Carolina, who is normally a good basketball team, North Carolina, the state, has always been blessed to have really good, two good basketball teams in college, Duke and North Carolina. North Carolina's terrible this year. Roy Williams, I don't know what has happened up there, but they're terrible. They're not going to make the NCAA tournament. So that's one power you don't even have to worry about. Kentucky's sort of up and down, too, as far as their effort is concerned. Auburn, you know, they just lost, you mentioned it, to Texas A&M. LSU, who's good, lost to a 6-10 Arkansas team. I mean, if there was ever a year that some of these littler schools, these littler basketball programs from these really small conferences ever had a chance, the SWAC, it's the Southwest American Conference, they can do it. I think this might be the year we see one of these, as they call them, what, Cinderellas, take the crown.
Well, the NCAA basketball tournament gets underway in a couple of weeks, and then, of course, the SEC tournament is in Nashville, and that gets underway on Wednesday the 11th, I think it is.
I think so.
There's a playing game Tuesday night. So Alabama will be one and done. And I have a premise then. You're a basketball guy, and I'm not a basketball guy, so I'm going to give you the way I look at it. If a tree falls in the woods and nobody is there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Well, yes.
Well, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. If a college doesn't have a football team and plays basketball, are they still a college? Just asking.
There are several of those out there.
Just asking.
A few in this state.
Speaking of Nashville, and we'll close on this, we are offering our podcast now to our sister station, Fun 93.5 FM, 1090 AM, WTNK in Hartsville, which is online if you want to listen to it at funradiotn.com. But the Nashville area and Lebanon, Wilson County, of course, a bordering neighbor to the south of Trousdale County, where our station is located, we were able to go on the air on Tuesday and do a wall-to-wall broadcast to hopefully help a lot of people up there that needed help as to where to go and what to do following the aftermath of that tragic outbreak of tornado, or that one tornado that went 90 miles on the ground, or whatever they're saying now. And there was a lot of people that were displaced, a lot more people dead. Of course, it happened in the still of the night. A lot of people were in bed, never got the warning. To the east of where we're located in Cookeville, a tremendous death toll of near 30. In the Nashville area, 6 dead, including 3 in Wilson County, our neighbor. And I can't help but reflect back on 2011 and the tornado outbreak in Alabama, of which Fun Radio became a part of to try to help people survive and rebuild and reconquer. But I'm in Tennessee on that Friday afternoon, and the damage and the detours you're having to take brought back a flood of memories. But you know, Adam, I've got to say this, and I've said this ever since the tornado outbreak in Alabama in 2011, that we have national championship teams in Alabama, whether it be on the college level or even the high school level with our cheerleaders and some of our high school basketball teams and wrestling teams and all that. We have national championship teams in Alabama because we have national championship people.
Yeah.
And that proved itself in Tennessee. You know, I lived in California, and people have heard this story, I know, 1,000 times, but I want to repeat it again. I lived in California in 1994, and the earthquake struck our home, and we were 10 miles from the epicenter, the 10 miles from where that 6.9 earthquake quake 22 miles under the earth moved a half an inch and caused all that damage in Southern California. And we went through that. And for days, we were without power. We were without, grocery stores were closed. I mean, everybody was in just, where do you go to get water? Where do you go to do this? Where do you go to do that? Where do I go to find somebody that'll pick up take these broken limbs out of the trees and so forth and so on. And people there were, you know, not bad people, but they didn't get out in mass and help each other. They waited for the Red Cross. They waited for whatever FEMA was back in that day, or whatever the case might be, help from the government, from the state, from the city, whatever. In Alabama in 2011, if nothing else, proved to me the timbre of this people, of the people of the South, was within 15 minutes of the tornado crossing the main artery on Brindley Mountain on 231, you heard chainsaws and you saw pickup trucks with people you'd never seen before.
Yeah.
Working all day, all night, all day the next day without sleep, a lot of times without food, maybe a bottle or two of water. You saw our faith-based families of churches come out the very next morning with breakfast, hot cocoa, bottled water, blankets, whatever, tarpaulins. The congregation in T-shirts and blue jeans and work boots going out and trudging and helping people left and right.
Right.
In Tennessee, I was so happy to witness that same thing.
Yep.
And, you know, the big, what was the hurricane that hit up in New York, New Jersey a couple of years? Sandy. Hurricane mm-hmm. Sandy. And it destroyed much of the Jersey Shore, and it tore up Long Island, and it went on up the East Coast. And I can remember looking at, watching the television reports from Channel 7 up there, or Channel 2, or whatever, and seeing the beach scene and seeing all these destructed pieces of property and people just looking around gawking, and no chainsaws, no pickup trucks, no people with their sleeves worked rolled up, moving anything, waiting for the emergency personnel to get there days afterwards.
Right.
Whereas in Nashville and in Cookeville and in Lebanon and Mount Juliet, Hermitage, and all the towns that were affected, those people were out before the crack of dawn on mm-hmm. Tuesday and are still out, I'll bet you, even as we speak, doing what they have to do or what they want to do,
right,
which is even bigger, to help their neighbors.
Right.
To me, that's God's love. That is the human spirit, the way God intended it to be.
Yeah, it is. And I'll tell you one thing that, just speaking from the area in which we live alone, I saw a number of people within the last 24 to 48 hours saying, "Hey, I'm preparing to go to Nashville. I'm going to take supplies up. I don't have the equipment to you know to have a chainsaw or anything like that, but I can take supplies. I can take things people might need. So if you've got extra clothes that you don't wear that you want to donate for somebody that may have lost everything and doesn't have a thing of clothes, or you know, if you want to have, you know, I'm going to cook for people while we're up there, or whatever it is, I'm loading the vehicle up. You've got 4 hours, you know, to get here before I leave, you know, kind of deal." And there were pictures and videos on social media. I even got a couple of texts about it, you know, "Hey, just tell people about this." And you know, people were showing up, and you can see it in the picture. People were literally showing up, you know, carrying 10 cases of water,
mm-hmm.
or you know, bringing grocery bag fulls of different items, whatever it might be, clothes or food or whatever. And then, of course, you think about just the regular Joes doing that kind of thing, guys in their pickups and loading up with the trailers with bulldozers on the back and all this stuff. We don't think about how these businesses here respond as well. I can tell you, where I live in Rainesville, we have one of the best electric co-ops ever. I'm convinced of that. A lot of people rave about the internet service there from Farmers. Shameless plugs there. But we have one of the best electric co-ops ever, because they don't end up just serving us. When something like this happens, you're going to find a group of about 10 or 12 guys from that co-op that says, "We're going to load the trucks up. We're going to fill them with gas. We're going to take our line poles, or, you know, we're going to take our bucket trucks, and we're going to go find some of these other co-ops and ask them, 'Hey, do you need some extra hands? We brought our trucks with us. You need some hands? We're going to go down the road here. You work on that line. We're going to go down the road and work on these lines for you. We're going to help you guys out, make sure you get power restored." Because a lot of times we don't think about it. Those businesses up there, anywhere, when this happens, they typically get shorthanded pretty quick just due to the amount
Absolutely.
Of damage.
Absolutely.
So it's not just
they
about
get overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's not just about, you know, picking up the limbs out of the yard or making sure the sidewalk's cleared off or reopening the roads. A lot of people don't think about, like, you know, we mentioned the other day on our wall-to-wall coverage, the gas company had come out and was surveying the lines and seeing where they broke, where they need to close off and work on the lines. You know, those kinds of companies need help too, and that's when they rely on somebody like the Rainesville Sand Mountain Electric Co-op to mm-hmm. come out. And, I mean, literally, they will spend days upon days out there. They respond when a hurricane hits in the south. When Florida was rocked last year, they were there. I mean, quite literally, a man in my church at that time that I was attending works on lines. He's a lineman. And he was gone for about a week and a half, didn't see his family. He was down there helping. Mm-hmm. And he came back with some stories. He's like, I worked for 18 straight hours before I got any rest. He said, we stopped maybe 5 minutes and ate a quick sandwich that somebody had brought us, and that was it. The rest of the time, we got one line done. Mm-hmm. We're going down the road and work on the other. Yep. And so, you know, and that's a big, big kudos to not just the people in Nashville or surrounding areas that weren't affected that can come out and help. But that ought to tell you that it's not just those people that come out. You get people from all over, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, coming up, and you hear all these stories. Or I would dare say there's probably some in Kentucky that would even come down. You hear all these stories about all these people coming from all over the place just to help. And if they get told, hey, well, we don't need you here, they don't just say, well, then you don't need me, I'm going home. They say, okay, you might not need me here. I'm going to go find a place that will use my talents. I'm not just going to go home.
Right.
You know, and I think that is so wonderful.
One of the things, and again, the spirit of the South, the championship spirit of the South's people come out when times get tough.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that goes back to the teams that they produce on the field. you got to be tough on the field. You got to be tougher in life.
Yeah, you do.
And in closing, that's a very good point. But I think it was a very telltelling sign where Tuesday afternoon, when we were saying people can go and donate blood or go to the Red Cross shelters and mm-hmm. help out for blankets, bring whatever. And the Red Cross right away got back and tweeted out and had it on their Facebook and got it out. Hey, folks, we love you. We're overwhelmed. We can't handle anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we got everything there. We got what we need. Thank you. But, I mean, people bringing cat food and dog food and bringing blankets and bringing handy wipes or baby wipes or bringing diapers or whatever. And they showed Channel 2. I was watching Channel 2 Wednesday, and they were showing the warehouse of the Nashville Red Cross, which is down off West End Avenue over by Vandy. And I know the building well, and they walked in the doors, and it was at the floor to ceiling as far as you could see of everything.
Yeah.
And 90% the lady got on and said 90% of what you see in here came in here yesterday.
Wow.
And we spent overnight with forklifts and so forth getting it sorted out and arranged to organized. Now we can organize. So now we can. That tells you what people of the South are all about.
Oh yeah, and of course to the people in Nashville. Our continued prayers go out to you, especially those who not only lost a home or had property damage of any sort, but those who especially who've lost loved ones, those who are in the hospital continuing to hurt and fight for life. We continue to pray for you guys. And, of course, we're always here. We'll be your fun family. We're always on for you.
We want to thank our friends at Jerry Damson Ford for being the sponsor of our podcast today. And if you have a need for a vehicle, talking about one of them pickup trucks you can throw a chainsaw in the back of and go help a neighbor, they've got one heck of a selection. So check them out on Brindley Mountain Parkway. All our crew down there, we really think the world of them. It's a beautiful place to shop, by the way, too.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll be back next week. The Fun Radio, Fun and Then Some podcast. For Adam Ward, I'm Michael St. John. Have a great week.